items to start. Would like to, we all had a chance to introduce ourselves at our first committee meeting, and would call on Senator Gimsey to start that for us today.
Thank you for the opportunity, Senator. Again, I'm Joe Gimsey. I'm Senate District 13 out of Wilmer, Minnesota. I don't know to what extent we do the introductions, but I'm happy to be here, and I look forward to the work that we'll do on this committee.
Great. Also would like to introduce someone who needs no introduction around the legislature, Peter Watson. Peter will be counsel for a subcommittee. And also would like to introduce my legislative assistant, Jason Tiedemann, who will be working with the subcommittee, who also was not here at the first meeting. Wanted to also begin by thanking Senator Rest for asking me to chair the election subcommittee. I'm excited about this process, and we thought that we would get a start today by hearing from our new Secretary of State, Mark Ritchie, and give us some a little bit of an overview of the Elections Division and some of his thoughts and visions for the future in Minnesota as it relates to elections. Welcome, Secretary of State Mark Ritchie.
Thank you, Chairman Larson, members of the committee, and distinguished guests. Thank you for this opportunity to testify before you this morning, giving you an overview of what we're hearing in our first round of meeting with stakeholders and some ideas of the things we'll be bringing forward, both on the legislative side, but also some of our other initiatives. But I also want to spend a moment just giving you an outline of the things that the Office of Secretary of State does do in the general administration of elections, because I've come to realize that there's some confusion or there have been some difference of opinion of this in the past. So let me just be specific about how we'll be approaching this. I have the title of Chief Election Officer. That does not mean that I run the elections. Township officials, school board members, city clerks, county auditors run our elections. The Office of Secretary of State has a very important role to play, but the elections are run at the local level, and this has been a real backbone, real important part of our state's history and how we do elections. But we do help in many ways as the Chief Election Officer and our Election Division. One is, of course, working with legislators in terms of innovating on policy and looking at the different implications of different ways of approaching some of our election questions. Second is helping local officials, township officials, and others on matters that have to do with elections. Sometimes it's forms, advice, legal opinion. Sometimes it's helping people with their structure of their training, a whole range of things that we can do to be helpful in terms of helping administration. The third is there are certain services that we now provide, some of them being mandated at the federal level, some mandated at the state level. Perhaps the most important is the statewide voter registration system. Minnesota is actually one of the national leaders, but we have a statewide system where we provide that service, and that is now expanding to help cities and counties work with absentee ballot and some of the other tasks that have to be produced for each election cycle. We also handle unusual circumstances, recounts, for example. There were a number of recounts in the past election. When they go across county lines, the Secretary of State's office is responsible. There seems to be some controversy about exactly how that's done, but that's an important role. Sometimes there are untimely deaths. There are other unusual circumstances. That's another place where the Secretary of State plays an important role as the Chief Elections Officer. We do have increasing federal law and some state law that are beginning to mandate certain programs, certain standards, certain requirements. By far the most important, the largest, the Help America Vote Act, and the implementation of the election equipment to make it possible for people with limited or no vision or some other physical disability to be able to vote. I think most of you who voted saw in your polling place some of that new equipment. It's a tremendous amount of money funneled from the federal government to the legislature, some of that money to the Office of Secretary of State to then be dispersed to the counties and to some of the other units of government. But increasingly, we're going to see more federal mandates, possibly more state mandates. The Secretary of State's office will most likely play an increasing role in being part of the transmission of those federal and local mandates. And finally, I will chair the canvassing board, which is the board that certifies the results I've observed only one. It's a combination of Supreme Court justices and district judges, and that's the kind of final place where the stamp that says, yes, this election result is certified. That's a quick summary. Perhaps in questions we can talk about those more in depth, but let me get to the legislative part because I think that's at the heart of why we're here today. We've been meeting with county auditors, with township officials, school boards, counties, advocacy groups, disability community, different parts of our community, and we've been hearing a lot of things. We've been absorbing those questions, those ideas. We've been looking at where consensus is building, and we're beginning to see a kind of general framework that I want to spell out today. That framework we'll be developing very specifically, and we'll be going forward with, you know, some media and some more formal testimony, but let me summarize it quickly for today. The first is that there's quite a bit of what could be called housekeeping and a lot of consensus. This year we implemented the Help America Vote Act with the special machinery. We also implemented the post-election audit or review that that you passed last year. There's some tweaking that needs to be done, some things that need to happen. I believe there'll be really strong consensus among all the stakeholders on a housekeeping bill, and that's being developed right now. The second is that as we've met with different stakeholder groups, you can hear in the conversations large initiatives that people are interested in. For example, for anyone who has the responsibility of coming up with election judges, the current system we have where you have to declare that you are a member of a major political party before you can be allowed to be an election judge creates a tremendous barrier, tremendous problems. Everybody complains about this. You'll see very specific legislation coming forward to change that to better system. I think that I haven't heard big differences or things that you would consider opposing views. I've heard a lot of consensus, but everybody has a different expertise, a different responsibility. So you'll see some of those coming forward out of those different constituency groups. And then finally, as the Secretary of State, our office will come forth with a major package of things that we've been developing, but also that we are partnering with others on. And let me quickly give you just kind of the bullet points of those. Again, these are things that we are in the midst of considering. We're getting feedback. We're getting input. But I want you to hear them so that early on we can start the process of conversation, because at the end of the day, I need your guidance, your input, your ideas, blending with others so that we can really have a package that can move with the kind of consensus support that I believe election and election administration really deserves. So the first one is measures that would reduce the cost to local election officials and reduce the time of citizens to get registered and to vote. We have all kinds of different systems and mechanisms, but there are many ways that we can improve this. For example, the county auditors have a very interesting proposal for a more automatic voter registration system. So when you've already stood in line for your driver's license or your learner's permit or your ID, that you could be automatically registered unless you chose to opt out. People are now looking at online registration. This is happening in a few other states. There's some very interesting experiments. That seems like something that we need to look at. How we do our postal change of address in Minnesota could be linked to help us update our voter registration files so that people aren't being lost in the system because they've changed addresses, but they haven't been captured in the system. We believe there are ways to save money at the local level, particularly the county level, and to save time for citizens. And we're going to come forward with some ideas on that. More information to voters. I heard this time and again as I traveled the state the last couple years. I'm assuming you've had a similar experience. People just want some basic information. Where do I vote? How do I vote? What's an absentee ballot? What's required if I show up? Many states now provide voter guides online or printed and mailed and distributed. We think there are ways to do this, not at a huge cost, but we do believe there are ways to get information out to people. I myself have also been working closely with the Governor's Commission on the Deaf and Hard of Hearing because particularly the deaf community has felt like there's hardly any information for them about how to participate in the process. This is true just in terms of the increasing number of people speaking other languages as primary languages in the state. You know, we're a changing state. We're a changing demographic. Our information needs to be out there. It needs to be in the languages or in the form that people can use it, our deaf community and others. And we need to be putting out more, perhaps more basic information. I know I've been strongly influenced by just talking to many election judges who've described to me just how basic of information many voters need to make the process go smoothly. Third is simplification of our absentee voting system. I've gotten emails and phone calls and personal visits from a lot of people who had problems with our absentee voting system, especially people in the military or people overseas. The notary requirement is impossible for many to meet. We need faster delivery options if you're overseas. We need to expand the agent delivery. If your mother's sick at home, you need to have a system. We need to adopt the Senate's ideas that have been expressed in the past about people having the right to do absentee voting without having to make up an excuse or make up some sort of reason. So that's simplifying that whole process. Enhancing election integrity. I know it's come up before and probably in front of this committee, but secretaries of state and our key election officials should not be on campaign committees. It just it's an office that needs to be above question. And also, if I'm running for re-election and I'm within the margin of error, I should not be in charge of my recount. We need another system that makes the public know that we are looking at the integrity of elections. Our software coding on these voting machines, lots of concerns because of the national news. We need to have public disclosure of how our votes are being counted. We need to be using open source software where we can, especially when we can save money. A kind of connection to some of these issues on military voting. I've spent quite a bit of time meeting with the officials in the military, especially with the 88th, the reserves that are based here. Just on all the problems, tremendous problems, even for troops based in the United States. If they were in the midst of training, they just weren't forwarding mail. People could not get mail even here. But if you're in Iraq or Afghanistan, there's just a lot of problems. And I'll be out in the next couple weeks out at Fort Snelling meeting with a lot of the key people there to get their ideas, but there is much that we can do to make it more possible for our soldiers in the country and overseas to vote, and we need to do that, and we need to do that without hesitation. It's a sixth item, expanding Election Day registration options. This is especially the case for identification. You know, you've been through lots of debates about this. The Help America Vote Act has a list of potential identification options that Minnesota has not yet adopted. We need to look at them, especially for young people. Young people don't often have the kind of IDs that some of us might have. Things like leases, driver's licenses from other states, satellite TV bills. If a digital cable bill is acceptable, why not a satellite bill? We need to broaden the scope of student housing lists. We need to look at how our residential housing lists are constructed. We just need to address some of the problems that we identified this year. We don't need to be going to court on election day to get judges' rulings to straighten out these problems. We need to address them in advance. Seventh, election administration. We need to clarify things like the location of filing. We had problems with that in the last election. How people use the option of getting signatures in lieu of filing a fee. We had to go to the Supreme Court over this in the last election cycle. We need to straighten out provisions even about removing names from ballots. There's some election administration cleaning up that's needed and important to do. Ranked voting. We know that Minneapolis citizens have voted to implement a form of ranked voting, instant runoff voting, sometime in the near future. I've been working with Cynthia Reichardt and the others in the city. We're aware that there needs to be a set of standards so that they aren't pursuing a way of doing ranked voting that would be contrary to Minnesota law, or they don't want to get a process that in the future would be contrary to some future standard. So I'm going to be proposing a kind of a task force to look at standards for instant runoff voting, and there'll be a lot of other legislation coming forward as well. So we want to kind of make that conversation happen. Ninth, Safe at Home. The legislature last session enacted a new program, a way for women in battered women's shelter or otherwise threatened to be able to have a safe mailbox to go back and forth for some written communications. There's a little tweaking of it, but this is the session for providing funding for that program. Office of Secretary of State has that responsibility, so that'll come forward. And finally, doing more to encourage young adult voting. I think it's clear enough now, although we don't have absolutely every statistic in, but again, young people continue to vote in lower numbers. And some of the reasons, I think, you know, I mentioned earlier about some forms of ID, getting the student, how we do our student system. I also think things like early registration. Hawaii and other states are allowing young people to be registered early so that when they turn 18, they're automatically registered. Too many of our young people are dropping out of high school, so that programs that target seniors or graduating seniors for voter registration really do miss, I'm very sad to say, up to half of the young people in some cities where we're having very high dropout rates. So we need to be looking at the problem of young people voting always and consistently lower and doing what we can. And again, there's some education and outreach parts of that as well. These are some of the things and kind of main areas in the legislative, but there are a few other things that we're going to be doing that aren't necessarily in the legislative area, but let me close by just giving you a brief look at those because they may be of interest. The first is that we're beginning to develop partnerships and initiatives with others around the whole notion of civic engagement and expanding our capacity. We're building a partnership with the Humphrey Institute Center for the Study of Politics and Governance to create a training center for election administration, a ways to provide the sort of updates and the really futuristic developments around training, finding ways to do that more successfully here. We're talking with Public Television, who's interested in using the TV to talk about civic engagement. Excuse me. Last week I met with the governor's Sesquicentennial Commission. It's the 150th year for the Blue Book, which is a responsibility of Secretary of State. And, of course, there's a governor's commission looking at the 150th year of our state's history. And so we're talking about ways to partner so that we can use that special tool, the Blue Book, to be kind of a key part of what they want to do to promote history. I'll be preparing a report on the state of Minnesota's democracy. We're a state that's very proud of our high turnout, of our civic engagement. We're also a state that's aware of some of the places where we need to continue making improvements, and I want to take a close look at that as a way to be imagining longer-term thinking. And then finally, I think we all know we sit inside this national system that isn't as good as our state system. I don't think I'm being overly arrogant to say Minnesota has a much better system than most other states. But in any case, we sit inside a national system. When there are problems with elections in other states, people here see it in the national news, and they begin to think that the same problems exist here. Time and again in the last 24 months as I've traveled the state, people would grab my arm if I was shaking their hands in a parade and say, don't let them steal our vote, or don't let them bring in those Diebold machines. And I'm just very aware that as long as the national system doesn't meet certain basic standards, like having a paper ballot so you could have a recount, Minnesota citizens are going to be hearing that news and wondering or worrying that the same problems face us here. And in any case, we all live under a national system. And so Minnesota needs to not just be proud of and defend and improve our system here. We need to be speaking out more at a national level. If we're going to live under one president and if our citizens are going to be alarmed by what they hear in other states, I need to be speaking out about it, both talking to our citizens about the great system we have here and why it's great, and then speaking loudly about why our system is good and why other parts of the country might want to take a look at how we've done this system. Again, thank you, Chairman Larson, for this opportunity, and I would be very happy to take any questions or answer any ideas, and I'd love to hear your ideas and ideas from the other senators if we can take some time to do that today. Thank you again.
Thank you. First question I have is a little bit of an open question as it relates to the 2006 election. And have you heard from local election officials to a large degree about any problems that we had in 06 that perhaps we have to take a look at or have to investigate further.
Thank you, Chairman Larson, members of the committee. Three things came up in the sessions with the county auditors that I was a little surprised about, and so I think would fit in line with your question. One is that I think we all were aware of the problems with challengers in 2004, lawyers flown in from Texas and Washington and D.C. and places, and the Senate and the House together passed a bill to change the rules of challengers. And these are folks who can come into, election and into a polling place and challenge somebody's right to vote or their eligibility. Well, the law was changed. I think many places saw a great deal of improvement, but two of the auditors reported that when they met with their county commissioners, the county commissioners said there were still problems with challengers in some places. And I wrote their names down. I'm going to meet with them. I want to get to the bottom of that. Was it really specific? Was it student areas? Was it, I don't know. But there seems to still be some problems with challengers that I myself did not hear about on Election Day. I was a little tied up, so I might not have been listening. But in any case, that's one thing. The second thing is that in the process of implementing the new equipment, I think the average number that I've heard from the local election officials is about 10% of the new disability-enabled machines failed either in prior testing or in the course of testing or in the course of the day. New technology, there's always problems, no real explanation, but that just seems like way too much. And the hassle on Election Day when you're trying to deal with everybody, this was not a presidential year. That kind of failure rate in a presidential year when everybody is so stressed, it's just unacceptable. And so I've asked for a meeting with the company. We more or less have a monopoly, or we've granted the contract on a monopoly basis to one company. I'm going to be meeting with them to find out. It turns out some of the substitute equipment was not new equipment. It was refurbished equipment, which is in violation of the contract. And there's some other problems. So this is just, I don't know, but I want to get to the bottom of it. Then the final thing is that, there were still cases where people felt like there hadn't been enough training of election judges on specific things that came up, or there hadn't been enough time in the training because the new equipment, there were so many new things that had to be done. And we just need to make sure that we are taking the time in our training of our election officials so that they feel like they're comfortable with, if it's new equipment, if it's new mandates, how many feet from the door can things be, all that stuff. So those three areas, the challengers, some problems with equipment supplier, and then making sure that our training is adequate and perhaps expanded, or at least three things that I've heard meeting with the election officials.
I don't know if everyone had the chance to be at the One Minnesota conference yesterday, but I thought it was an excellent presentation. I know many of us were there, and I think I saw you there, Secretary Ritchie, at some point. I don't know if you were able to stay for the afternoon session, but as we were hearing from thought leaders and business leaders, one of our business leaders in Minnesota, Vance Opperman, suggested that one of the many things that we ought to be doing that we just should get on with, and one of those is online voting. Mm. That ultimately we're an online world, and we can do just about anything online. We ought to be able to vote via internet, whether we're in Minnesota or not, and then we ought to be able to find a system to make that happen. I'm curious how much you've thought about that, and where are we headed with today's technology and tomorrow's.
Chairman Larson, members of the committee, thank you for that question. This fall, I had the privilege of sitting with a friend and online voting in Holland. I was here, and he's a citizen of the United States and Holland, and Holland this year was their first year of using online voting in their national elections. He voted 2 years ago in European elections, and so I sat with him as he went through the whole process, and then he showed me the results. So for me, it was a more trying to get a look at what that system might look like, because the military has been using it on a kind of limited basis in the United States. But they have made the statement that there is not a constitutional right to a secret ballot. So the military's thinking about how to do it is not designed to secure the right of a secret ballot. And I don't know if it's constitutional or not, but I grew up expecting a secret ballot, and I think most people do. So the Dutch system was built to be absolutely secret. It was impressive. Our military system is not designed to be secret, and if you're a private and your sergeant might know how you voted or so on and so forth, this may not be how you want to conduct internet voting or online voting. So I have my concerns. I've been talking to the computer people about this. They expect that at the size and scale of the United States and also the sophistication, particularly of criminal elements in the United States, that we're 20-some years away from the kind of security systems that might be necessary for people to feel a lot of confidence. That being said, people who are overseas need to be able to use the internet to do things like order their absentee ballot, get some of these materials. And so I'm impressed by what I've seen that other countries have done. I'm alarmed at what I've seen that our military is proposing. I want to make sure that we're using the internet right now for the things that it could help us with, and I want to be absolutely certain that the level of security that people are describing is needed is in place. That being said, right at the moment, a paper ballot that gets marked with a pen, gets run through an optical scan and stacked someplace, is by far the cheapest, the most accurate, and the most developed system. And I may sometime ask Mr. Opperman out to lunch to get his ideas. Of course, he's in the business, so you have to be a little cautious when somebody's in the business and they're promoting their approach. But he's, of course, very successful and very smart about these things, and I would love to hear his ideas. And I would be very, very appreciative of hearing any of your ideas or suggestions about, you know, how this might develop. I think at the end of the day, it's somehow cell phones and that whole thing for voting. But we're still a ways from that.
Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman and Secretary Ritchie, on that same line, I have two daughters who live in Israel, and they have dual citizenship. So I kind of assumed they don't live in Minnesota, so they're not eligible to vote here. But I never did really know. Are they eligible to vote in our national elections? Do you know?
Yes.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator Pappas, yes.
And how do they do that, Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pappas, there's actually a very good system. We have an overseas voting system, and there are ways to actually get the application, and perhaps I could provide that information very specifically. But what there isn't is very good information and publicity about the right, that we have that right and the fact that it exists. You're a very educated, very familiar with the political process person. I'm assuming your daughters, you know, share your interest. And so the fact that we haven't really gotten the word out, you know, is an indication of that there's more we can do. There are millions of Americans and many Minnesotans living and working overseas, young people on their college abroad, people working in our companies, our military, Peace Corps, you name it. There's a tremendous number of people, and we have not done the job to let them know of their right and their responsibility. And this is just an excellent example. And, you know, I'll make sure that you have that specific information and send to them because, you know, presidential elections are less than 2 years away.
They didn't get to vote for their mom.
That's all right.
We already discussed that, though. They couldn't because they don't live in Minnesota.
You know they were going to?
No.
That perhaps raises other questions about absentee voting, and I think there's a whole array of opinion about whether we ought to be absentee voting, you know, in a very restricted way or whether it ought to be fairly wide open. Tell us a little bit about that, if you would, in terms of where's the balance?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. The you know, Minnesota has we now have kind of done more or less the normal reforms of absentee voting in the sense that we now have permanent absentee voting if you're, you know, permanently want to receiving your ballot in mail. I'm assuming this year there's a lot of good push. We'll get rid of the requirement that you lie and say you're going to be sick or something so that we have a kind of, you know, a no excuse needed. But absentee voting or voting by mail, which are closely related, Minnesota also has the beginnings of a system where towns or voting districts with 400 or less voters can vote by mail. Many townships have chosen this option because of the Help America Vote Act requirements on the equipment. I know in Kitson County they've chosen this option because they have blizzards in November and they're getting older and they don't want to drive the distances. And in Mankato, in special elections, two precincts side by side, a precinct had about a dozen voters come in, and the precinct right next to it, which was vote by mail, had 60% turnout. So, you know, counties are looking at the vote by mail option and saying, hey, we might need to raise that from 400 to 1,000, so we might see legislation coming to that. And if you look westward, you see western states moving very heavily towards vote by mail. The county voting officials in Idaho have now created a website, and they as a whole group are going to move Idaho towards vote by mail, which Oregon now has. Washington State adopted vote by mail on a county-by-county basis, and they're up to about 80%. Some states where vote by mail and permanent absentee ballot are allowed are moving above 33.5%, 34%, and I think in the case of some parts of California now, nearly 50%. People are choosing that option because of whatever in their lifestyle. So Minnesota now, I think we have a few things we can improve on absentee. I think the whole business of, you know, requiring a notary and all of that we should get rid of. But voting by mail is something that rural districts in particular are looking at. They're saying this is an option we want to consider. They're asking for some expanded flexibility. And I believe looking into the future, our western part of this country, and it just may be a sparse population, it may just be an independent-minded thinking, I don't know what, but our whole western region will move in this direction, and I think it's something we need to, track as closely as we can.
Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Secretary. I have some additional questions or issues to raise with regard to that. And first of all, did I hear you say that the voting participation in those areas where they do use mail ballots is higher? The voter turnout is higher than it is where voting by mail is not used. Is that
Mr.
correct?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rest, in the two sort of, I would say two quite different examples, in states that have moved towards vote by mail at a very large scale, their turnout has gone up. Oregon is right behind Minnesota, you know, Washington State, and their experience has been that does increase turnout. But very specifically in Minnesota, in Kitson County, precincts that had fallen to 50% went back up to near 100. Mankato, it was a special election. We all know how challenging special elections are. But they had two precincts side by side. This was an editorial in the Mankato paper. I think one either had a dozen all day or a dozen before noon, and the precinct next to it had 60% turnout in a special election because it was vote by mail. And they were just trying to make the point that in a special election in particular, we have problems with turnout.
Our school district had a one time tried a vote by mail approach on a referendum, and there was just outrage at it because, I mean, I don't know how it was exactly administered. And this was some years ago, and they've never done it again because there were so many complaints about it, about people who didn't recognize they were getting a mail vote, and they threw it away. Mm. And they, and then all of a sudden they want to know, well, is the school district, because it was a referendum, okay, on a building or the operating referendum, are they only mailing to certain people? I mean, this whole thing of the integrity of the election system through voting by mail, where how do you know what the error rate is in either ballots received or someone claiming that they mailed their ballot in and they really don't know? I mean, how do they know that their ballot was counted? And when, I mean, does it go into the record that in these places where they have it, that mm-hmm. shows up on their, now on their, you know, their computer database that, yes, so-and-so did send a ballot back. Mm-hmm. And I'm assuming that happens. Mm-hmm. But there was such dissatisfaction with it that they've never tried it again. And the I don't even remember whether the issue, whether the measure passed or failed, but they didn't do it again. Another issue that I'm working on now has to do with, and this is just kind of a project, not a piece of legislation, I think I might have mentioned it to you briefly before, is talking with school districts about polling places. Right now, of course, we try mostly to have polling place in a public place, in a public building. And in general, at least in the metropolitan area, as opposed to a township, for example, we use schools for the polling places. And school districts are becoming increasingly concerned for security issues about using schools, particularly elementary schools. And I've met with officials in Plymouth, which is, I only represent a small part of it, but it's the biggest city otherwise that is in my legislative district. And they are looking at what kind of a law change would need to be made to allow to move away. How many public buildings or public spaces can they identify that are not elementary schools that could meet the standard of the law for becoming a polling place? And one of the things that I'm sure you're aware of is that if there is no public building of any kind in your precinct, you may have a polling place that's outside of your precinct. Otherwise, the polling place has to be inside the precinct. But there's also, as far as I know, there is a requirement about the distance it can be from the precinct boundaries, and it's very minimal. I mean, it's like, I don't know, 300 feet or 300 yards or something. It has to be very, very close. And also, they have some people who live in Plymouth where they haven't been using, if they chanced not to use a school, that they would use a religious building, a church or whatever. And there are some people who object to that because they think it's a violation of church and state, and you know they'd much rather go into a school. In my discussions with school officials, again, they're more concerned almost building by building, and because elementary schools tend to be more open, at least the ones in our area, they're more open spaces. The security is much more difficult to carry out. And in some places, they've even asked parents to come in and volunteer on election day to be the security force. And they are, they don't want to do it, of course, because they're not trained. They wouldn't know what to do if, and yet they're concerned that, you know, maybe there are going to be 800 people, 900 people coming into an elementary school, vulnerable citizens, the students there, and not be able to assure the parents that the school is safe on that day. And then the other side of that is, well, okay, so what do you do? So do you close down the school on that day or have only a teacher prep day or something like that. So it's a day that's no student contact. So they're only adults in the building to start with. But the security, some of the security issues remain because people come in, let's say in the high schools, if they're not able to have secure the entrance, and there is more presence of security in high schools and for a lot of reasons than there is in the elementary schools. But if they're not able to do that, then they get people wandering into the building who weren't there to vote to start with, and they're there maybe to sell drugs, they're there to steal things, and they use the meandering in of otherwise adults to vote as a shield for activity that is inappropriate. So we never used to talk about that kind of thing with regard to elections, but I think following 9/11 that we are in more concern about having safe schools, that those issues are coming up. And I know I certainly would be amenable to having as long as we had some standards for the polling place was immediately recognizable to the voters. I mean, you know, it's like I can't think of what it might be, but some public building or something that was let's say a high school could have more than one precinct voting in it. Everybody knows where it is. It's a secure entrance there. You could take care of that. You wouldn't have to use an elementary school in particular. Anyway, Plymouth is looking at that, and I think I mentioned that to you before, that I hope that you will have a conversation with them. The other thing that I found interesting in looking at the security issues of polling places is that although security is a big issue, you may not station a police officer in a polling place because it is considered intimidation by the government over our right to vote. Mm. And so in Plymouth, what they do, because they are concerned about it, they send a police officer in a squad car who goes and makes, on that day, makes, you know, kind of circles around and is kind of available, and the school knows that the person, the police officer, is on call for disturbances at, particularly on those voting days, is available, but you can't have a cop in a polling place, as far as I understand, and it makes a lot of sense why we wouldn't want to do that in terms of voters feeling, on the one hand, intimidated, but on the other hand, is the issue of security for the children in a polling place. So that is going to be an issue that I continue to explore. And I don't know what the solution to it is, but school districts, or at least my school district, one of my school districts, is very concerned about what they see to be kind of a double mission that's contradictory. First obligation in terms of the physical is the physical safety of the students in that building, and then also to be a place where people can come to exercise their right to vote, and they're not always in sync.
Secretary Ritchie?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator Rest, at some point I want to return to the question of the school board election, because that sounds like a wild story, and I'd really like to get all the details so I could be very informed about that. But let me go right to this question of the schools, because at the meeting of the clerks of the metro area, which I think was about 2 weeks ago, this came up as a major topic.
Okay.
I would suggest it would be worthy of a hearing. And it was 9/11 and, of course, the shootings that have taken place in our own state and others. And we have a provision, so I'm now repeating part of that conversation. This is not what I know directly, but in that conversation, that Minnesota has policy requiring public buildings be made available. Other states don't. North Dakota, I think, was cited, and they are just getting the polling out of the schools. And so there's a crisis, and they are predicting that kind of a crisis here because we also use some private schools. We also use
Mr. Secretary, where do they vote then if they don't vote in the schools?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Reza, I don't know. It was raised in the context of saying we've got a few years to figure this out, but the pressure's coming. Now, some school districts even went as far as plain-clothed armed security people in other parts of the building. So people have taken this as a very serious matter. They discussed three things very specific that they thought were kind of short-term, but I believe there's a larger conversation with the Homeland Security people, because a lot of the pressure is coming from them, the school security people, the superintendents. Three things. First one was, they felt strongly about this, and I think we're going to be talking about this in relationship to our military voting and others, is move the primary to August, so at least one of our election days we're not there with kids. The second one is that every district almost, and we were talking to school district people, has an in-service day that week. Move it to Tuesday. Mm-hmm. You know, it wouldn't be that complicated. The third thing, you alluded to this, I believe the current rule is 1,000 yards outside of the precinct. There's a proposal to raise it to a mile, that a mile outside of a precinct. This is a little easier for us in the cities. Really, in some rural areas, this is a very complicated problem. Right. You know, there are no other options. And so I believe there'll be a proposal from the clerks or somebody about a 1 mile outside the precinct polling place option. And, you know, that might help, you know, a couple things. And then finally, they're looking at the question of trying to understand how the whole security equation and the public school equations fits together, because the pushback on moving, and I vote in the Greek Orthodox Church next door to my house, very convenient. People of Muslim faith have other questions about, you know, so we're getting into some other areas. Our Help America Vote Act accessibility questions come into play on and on. You mentioned having police. We need to be listening to our clerks who are really running the elections and our judges who are having to manage this problem, the school officials and the parents, because it's the parents pushing on the school officials apart, and to begin looking for a longer-term solution. And because the conversation was clear that this is going on in almost every other state, there's also probably some ideas and some approaches that we could pull together. And we noted at the end of the meeting that this was just the first conversation. The clerks want to keep talking about it because it's kind of their problem in a way. And I would look forward to another opportunity where I could be more thoughtful and more informed myself. But also, it might be worthy of a hearing. And as a long-term measure, the availability of our public buildings for things like voting is a very important question, because for many places, it's the only option. But if the security questions become so severe it's no longer an option, then something different has to happen. And I very much appreciate you raising it, because I do think we need to be helping make the process of administering election as easy and as straightforward as possible. And the security things have made all of our lives more complicated, be it air travel or whatever, and it's made voting a lot more complicated.
Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Secretary Ritchie. You had mentioned, and we'd certainly heard this before, that we have the lowest voter turnout in our 18 to 24-year-old population. And I've often thought of voting as really just a habit. And I used to always take my kids with me to the voting booth, and when we had the big old machines and the curtained booth, they would come in with me, and, you know, they'd kind of see what the whole process was like. But I had a proposal a number of years ago to lower the voting age to age 16. And I'm especially, hadn't thought about pursuing it again, but maybe it'd be a good idea, and especially in school board elections. Now, women first got the vote in school board elections before they got full franchise, and it was assumed that, well, women have, you know, concern about kids and schools, and that sounded like the right thing to do. Well, when you think about 16-year-olds, many of them are working, they're paying taxes, they're paying income taxes, they're certainly paying sales tax, and it could be a way to kind of engage them in being more interested and who runs their educational process. Certainly they're a customer of the education system. Maybe they should have some choice in who's in charge. And it gets them kind of in a habit of voting, like this is something I do. So I'd be interested, though, in your advice on if there's any technical issues that I should be aware of. You know, how do you register young people to only vote in one kind of election and not others? And how, what does that mean in terms of the ballot process? And is this going to be very complicated to do that? And maybe if it's too complicated, we just lower the voting age across the board to 16. But then, of course, they couldn't vote in federal elections because of the national situation.
Chair Ritchie.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pappas, Chairwoman Phyllis Kahn on the House side is strongly considering reintroducing her bill, which perhaps was a companion. So I believe this is going to come up, and I've just now started trying to understand what the implications might be. Getting young people registered at age 16 is happening in other states. I think it's something we should move to here, and it would, you know, start the process of at least getting people involved, getting information. Exactly how it would work if you had a differential with school board elections and others, we'd need to look at. But getting kids used to the process, the thing that you mentioned was it becomes a habit. I mean, it's absolutely in all the scientific literature, the research, that's the case. And when young people are interviewed about some of their reluctances to vote, sometimes it's just not knowing the process. And a few school districts have taken to bringing in election equipment for the voting for the homecoming king and queen. So everybody experiences the process. I think there's some
there's
other...
kids vote.
And there's Kids Vote, which is a big program in Minnesota, and, you know, that's one of the things that's happening. What I'm appreciative of is any idea that people have about things that we can do to help increase. I also know that, you know, as someone who just ran for office and all of you, if we're talking about things relevant to young people like schools and education, we get their interest. But I do think that, you know, more and more, when I graduated from high school, I could not vote. We didn't get the franchise lowered to the age of 18 until near the end of the Vietnam War, and some of us probably are about that age if we remember those machines. So the debate over the age of voting and the link of that to serving the country was pretty important to debate for me as a young person, and so I'm very interested in that. Different states have some different proposals. California has proposed one idea. When you're 16, you got one-fourth of a vote. When you were 17, you got one-half of a vote. And when you were 18, you were fully franchised. That's an interesting idea. I don't know how you would make it work, but it's an interesting idea. I do think Representative Kahn has thought about this, and she's going to be doing something, and I need to get busy and find out what I can so I can, you know, be knowledgeable and be able to answer your questions very directly and in an informed way going forward. I just think everything is moving down, and we need to be paying attention to that.
Senator Rust.
Certainly, just on that topic, think that young people should be more involved in civic life. I don't know that the proper way for them to be involved at age 16 is by voting. And I didn't support Representative Kahn's bill before. In fact, she started out with having 12-year-olds be the age of majority for voting.
Persuaded her to go to 16.
And one young 12-year-old just recently thought that the flags were at half staff because James Brown died and thought that was a really good way to honor him. And I'm not sure I want that 12-year-old voting at this point.
I know, a 22.
I also think that we have we do not have a single age of majority in this country. If a 16-year-old, we might say, what would be the argument that if a 16-year-old could vote, why can't a 16-year-old be president of the United States? Why do you have to be 35 years old? What is so magical about being 35? Or if the federal age of majority for voting is 18, why can't an 18-year-old? And I don't mean that we would vote for an 18-year-old. I mean he or she is forbidden by the Constitution from being considered for the presidency, and maybe there's some good reasons for that. And I would hope that we would, I guess I'm real conservative on this, but I would hope that we would explore a whole lot more things, ways of, like kids vote and so forth, of approaching people younger than 18 to be aware of the values of their democracy and all of that, than necessarily reducing the voting age to the driving age, where we even then are not, we don't let, I mean, driving is a privilege, not a right, but we have all kinds of restrictions on 16-year-old voters, and of course the age of majority, regardless of whether you serve in the military or not, for drinking alcoholic beverages in this country is 21. And, you know, some people will say, well, if I'm old enough to die for my country, why can't I have a drink? And all you have to do, in my mind, is look at the fatalities on our highways and who's responsible for them in terms of drunken driving, and you get an answer. And so I hope we don't, with good solid intentions of engaging in young people in voting, and particularly the 18 to 24-year-old group that doesn't vote, that we don't think we solve the problem by letting 16-year-olds vote. Just my cautions on that issue.
Well, and I think that we probably all play, you know, some level of role in our young people having involvement. I mean, Senator Pappas, you're bringing your daughters to the polls probably has, you know, more to do with their future willingness or interest in voting. I know that
they're not voting now, though.
Well, they're not voting
earlier.
That's
Israel.
A whole different problem. But I, you know, we with my 12-year-old and my 10-year-old, I always plan to vote early enough or late enough so that on that school day, they're able to go. And I have to say that I'm. The elections officials in the city in which I live are always prepared for that, very gracious and welcoming of the kids, making sure they get a sticker. They know it's a place where you get a cookie. I'm not sure that they like going there for exactly the reason that I'm trying to show them. But nonetheless, I mean, I think that responsibility falls on us as well. But any other questions for Secretary Ritchie? Any other thoughts?
Well, Chairman Larson, it's interesting. Let me just say one other thing about this issue. In general, the system has become so complicated that we are stretching the capacity of our local election officials, our judges, and all the people involved to sort of make it all work. So one of the kind of themes that we're going to have underneath our proposals and our ideas are the things that can help simplify and make it easier for voters and make it easier for our election administrators. I mean, we got a very complicated, and we can handle it now, but we're getting to the edge. And so as we hear proposals from different people, and, you know, it's for you and the policymakers to set the policy, and it's for us to try to figure out how to implement them. But I'm going to be constantly coming back and saying, can we make this simpler? Can we make this more direct? Can we make it easier for voters? Can we make it easier for our election officials who are really the backbone? And I very much appreciate your comments and thinking about this, you know, this part of the process. There are going to be lots of things important coming forward this year. I think we're going to make a lot of problem, a lot of things. But I'm looking forward to a long-term relationship with you and members of the committee, because we have a lot of things to address going forward. We'll only get some of them done this year. We'll have a lot more to do.
I look forward to working with you. And I see that Ms. Frazier is here from your office. Maybe if you'd
yes,
like.
Yes, would be appropriate to introduce our new Director of Governmental Affairs, Beth Frazier, who's been a staff for the Voting Rights Coalition for many years. Some of you might have met Beth. And Beth will have the main responsibility in our office, and she's out working with clerks and auditors, everybody, every day. So I feel very blessed, and I have a fabulous staff over there at the Secretary of State's office running the elections and the business services and all that. So I feel like, you know, it took me a while to get into the chair, but I'm there, And, you know, we're ready to go, and I very much appreciate having this early opportunity to preview and to start hearing your ideas and concerns, and I will get back to you on some of the specific things that people raise, but I look forward to speaking before you again and hearing from you, and you also know where my office is, so if you're walking by, stop in. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, and if there are no other questions, we'll adjourn the Subcommittee on Elections. I believe, Senator Rest, you're the only member of the Gaming Subcommittee.
Right.
That's right.
That
Subcommittee will convene at 4:15 right here in this room. Thank you.
They're not voting.